Let's turn in our Bibles to Daniel chapter 5. We've been working our way through the book of Daniel. And as I said, last time I began looking at chapter 5. And I want to continue and finish our study in chapter 5. We've been looking at the book of Daniel for a number of weeks now. And the main theme that I have as we study this book is simply this: how do we live a life honoring to God in a hostile world? We are in a world today, we're in a country today that is hostile to the gospel, that is hostile to Christianity. How do we as Christians live a life that honors God, that maintains a testimony for Jesus Christ in this hostile world? And the reason Daniel teaches us this is because they were in exactly the same situation that we are in. They were exiles in Babylon. They weren't in Israel. They were in Babylon. And there in Babylon, there is this hostile world of idolaters. Not a world that followed the religion of the Bible or the God of the Bible, but a nation that followed idolatry. And yet Daniel and his colleagues lived a God-honoring life. They never compromised on their beliefs. They never in any way gave way to the idolaters, but maintained their testimony. So we're studying the book of Daniel to learn this. How do we live a godly life, a God-honoring life? How do we maintain our testimony for Christ in a world that is hostile and anti-Christian? And we've been looking at various lessons that have come in the first four chapters. And last time I began to look at chapter 5, we looked at the first 12 verses of chapter 5. And I was looking then at this theme: what is the world in which we live? What are the characteristics of the world? What is it that marks out the world in which we live? Because those 12 verses of chapter 5, we get an insight into the fallen world, into the non-Christian world. You've got this banquet that Belshazzar threw. And you've got all his lords and his wives and his concubines, and they're all having this party. And in a sense, the Bible takes us into the banqueting hall of all these unbelievers. These are not Jewish people. These are not God-honoring people banqueting. These are idolaters banqueting. And the Bible takes us into this banqueting hall and says, here's a group of unbelievers. And this is what they're like. And this is how they behave. And this is how they think. And so we were looking at how this world is a proud and an arrogant world. And how this world is a hostile world. And how this world doesn't learn the lessons of history. And so on. We were looking at the first 12 verses. This evening then I want to move on from verse 13. Although I will be looking at some verses in the previous passage. But looking mainly from verse 13 onwards at the rest of this passage. And the theme that I have again this evening. We have looked at this theme in other passages. The theme again I have this evening is the character of our God. And the reason I bring this to you this evening, as I've said this before, is that if we are to live a life that is honoring to God, if we are to maintain a Christian testimony in a world that is hostile to the Christian faith and increasingly becoming even more hostile to the Christian faith, if we are to live a life that honors God and maintains our testimony, we must know who our God is. We must have a very clear idea of who is our God. What are His characteristics? What is His nature? Exactly who is He and what is He like? This is how we maintain a testimony. You know that later in the book of Daniel, we have that very famous phrase, the people who do know their God do mighty deeds. That's later in the book of Daniel. But that, in a sense, that one sentence is a kind of a cover of this book. This is the overarching theme of this book. This book is a revelation of God. This book takes us back to the character of God and says, this is your God. Make sure that you have a clear idea in your hearts, in your minds, of who He is. Because if we have a clear idea of who our God is, we will be able to live lives honoring to Him. This is why the Bible was given, that we may know who God is. This is why Christ came, to reveal God to us, that we might live lives that honor Him. So we're looking this evening then at the character of our God from this passage in chapter 5. Three things that I want to bring to your attention this evening, primarily from this passage. Three things. The first thing I want you to notice is this, that God is sovereign, or God is king. God is sovereign. In a sense, this passage is a little bit like the battle that took place between Moses and Pharaoh, or the battle that took place between Elijah and the prophets of Baal. You have these incidents in the Old Testament where you have these unbelievers, pagans, idolaters, and you have a man of God. And the pagans, the idolaters, they are rejoicing in their beliefs, in their idolatry, and in their hostility to God. And they are seeking to establish sovereignty. They are saying to God's people, our God is sovereign. This is what Pharaoh was trying to say to Moses. Pharaoh was saying to Moses, you Moses, you come and say to me, let my people go. But my gods, the Egyptian gods, they're the mighty gods. I can keep the people of Israel in slavery for as many years as I want, because I'm the most powerful man on earth, and my gods are the most powerful gods. And when Elijah came up against the prophets of Baal on the top of Mount Carmel, again, it was a similar kind of thing. The prophets of Baal stood before Elijah and they said, Baal is mighty. Baal is sovereign. Baal is all-powerful. And we will show you this. This challenge is taking place. And here again, you have Belshazzar. And Belshazzar, in a sense, is making exactly the same claim. He is saying, I am the most powerful, and my Babylonian gods are the most powerful. You remember last time when we began looking at this passage, we were looking at the opening verses. And in the opening verses it says, King Belshazzar made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in front of 1,000. Belshazzar, when he tasted the wine, commanded that the vessels of gold and of silver that Nebuchadnezzar his father had taken out of the temple of Jerusalem be brought, that the king and his lords, his wines and his concubines might drink from them. And we looked at this last time. Why do this? Is it because they'd run out of goblets? Well, of course not. Is it because they didn't have any more wine glasses? Well, of course not. This is obviously a statement. He knows all about these glasses that his ancestor Nebuchadnezzar has brought from Jerusalem. And he knows that these were holy vessels. He knows that Moses had given a law to the Israelites that some of these vessels were to be sanctified to God. And he knows that there were these Jewish ceremonies where they would take some items and they would sanctify them and separate them unto God so that they would be used for the glory of God and the service of God and wouldn't be used for ordinary means, but they were now holy vessels. That's how the Bible uses the word sanctification, or to be holy. It says certain things, certain people are removed from ordinary use in the world and brought unto God, separated unto Him for His use, for His worship. And Belshazzar knows this. And in this banquet, the wine has gone to his head, and he wants to show all these people who have gathered before him. It's a kind of a statement to show, this is how powerful I am, that I can even challenge the God of Israel. And so he says to his servants, He says, you know those glasses or those wine things that my ancestor brought from Jerusalem? Well, bring them, he says, and we will drink wine from them. And so it says that they brought in the golden vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God in Jerusalem. You notice how the writer underlines this. Doesn't just say the vessels that had been brought. It says the vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God in Jerusalem. There's this underlining there. These were the vessels that were in the temple. The temple was the house of the God of Israel, house of God in Jerusalem. And they brought them and they drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver and bronze and iron and wood and stone. So it wasn't just a drinking thing, this was a worship thing. Belshazzar is saying that these vessels had been used for the worship of God in Jerusalem. We are going to use them for the worship of our gods. And so it says there in verse 4 that as they drank the wine, they praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood and stone. It's a challenge saying we are the ones who are in authority, we are the ones who rule, and our gods are the ones who are sovereign and all powerful. Well, in the midst of it, and this is how the passage unfolds, because those first four verses, you have the challenge that Belshazzar throws down. In a sense, he's saying to the God of Israel, I challenge you to show me that you are king. I'm telling you, you are not king. I am king, and my gods, they're the ones who are kings. And verse 5, immediately, there and then, the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace opposite the lampstand. And the king saw the hand as it wrote, and the king's color changed, and his thoughts alarmed him. His limbs gave way, and his knees knocked together. There is a beautiful symmetry in this passage. The first four verses is the king proud, arrogant, boasting. And then verse 5, which is at the center of this short passage, you have God making an appearance, the hand appearing and writing on the wall. And then from verse 6, you have this kind of symmetry, whereas the first four verses, Belshazzar is proud and arrogant and boastful. From verse 6, it's the opposite. Belshazzar now, his color changes, his thoughts alarm him, his limbs give way, his knees knock together. Because God has displayed his sovereignty. Words have appeared on the wall. And he doesn't know what these words are. He doesn't know what they mean. But he knows that his sovereignty has been shown to show what it really has been shown to see what it really is. He's not king at all. And his Babylonian king gods are not kings at all. There is a God in heaven who rules. And they bring Daniel in. And they say to Daniel, you must interpret. And Daniel gives the interpretation. And this is what Daniel says. You go all the way to verse 26. And Daniel says, this is the interpretation of the matter. Mene, God has numbered the days of your kingdom. You see, this is a statement of authority, of sovereignty. Your rule is in the hands of God. God determines who rules Babylon. God determines how long they rule in Babylon. God determines when their rule comes to an end. It is God who determines these things. And so Daniel says to him, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. The end has come now. These things are in God's hands. They're not in your hand. You're not on the throne because of your political wisdom, or because of the way you're able to maneuver people and get popularity for yourself, or anything like that. You're only on the throne because God placed you on the throne. And when God is finished with you, he will dispose you. And that'll be it. So the interpretation, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. So it's not only the length of your reign, but you yourself, Belshazzar. You're not a great king. Your days are in the hands of God. Your life is in the hands of God. Your destiny is in the hands of God. And you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. And Perez, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. You might think the Babylonian kingdom is the greatest kingdom on the earth. It stretches over this vast geographical area. And it's got a powerful army and a superbly run civil service. But God is the ruler. And God has decided that the period of the Babylonian kingdom has come to an end, and it is time for the Medes and the Persians to now take over. The sovereignty of God established in this passage. I want you to notice something very interesting here. For 70 years, the Jews have been in Babylon. And I wonder how they felt during those 70 years. Because during those 70 years, occasionally they would have seen evidence of God's sovereignty. But for most of those 70 years, even to the most devout Jew, it would almost seem like God has lost control. Can you imagine if you were an Israelite and you were taken into exile in Babylon and you're having to live in Babylon and work for the government in Babylon? And make your living there in Babylon. And you're sitting there thinking, well, isn't God in control? How come we are here in Babylon? Why aren't we back in Jerusalem? Why aren't we in the temple? Why aren't we worshipping God? Why are we here? And at times it must have felt to them, during those 70 years, that somehow God has lost the compass. He's lost the plot. And somehow God is no longer in control. Because Christians go through these phases in their lives when it almost seems like there is nobody in control. Nations go through these phases. Our nation is going through this phase. And you look at the nation and how this nation is hurtling into further and further unbelief, into further rebellion against God. If you've lived in this nation more than 30 years, you're alarmed, you're absolutely shocked at how we've gone from, broadly speaking, a Christian country, where at least the Bible was honored and people sought at least to live by the Bible, to now a culture where the Bible is trampled underfoot, Christianity is laughed at, and unbiblical practices, people rejoice in them, promote them. And you look at this and you think, I thought God was in control. Well, God is in control. God never gives up the reins. God is always sovereign. We don't always see it, but God is always sovereign. And when the time comes, that the time that God has appointed, then he will act. Because 70 years had been appointed. You remember later in chapter 9, we will come to that passage. And the answer to Daniel's prayer, 70 years have been appointed for your people. And so when the 70 years had finished, then Daniel prayed and God moved. So God is sovereign. And we, as we live in a nation that is hostile to the Christian faith, we find ourselves increasingly being challenged and bewildered. We must take hold of this as a foundational stone of our faith so that we are always prayerful. Never stop praying. Never stop trusting in God. Do not lose your faith. Don't think to yourself, well, what's the point in being a Christian? The nation is going away from God. We see so few conversions. What's the point in being a Christian? God is sovereign. And we must always be prayerful. And we must always pray that God would visit us. He would visit us as a church. He would visit us as a nation. And he would revive us as a church and revive us as a nation. God is able. We never doubt God's ability. God is sovereign. So that's the first great lesson from this passage on the character of God, that God is sovereign. But there is a second lesson, and it is this, that God is gracious. God is gracious. Now you may say, well, where do you find the grace of God in this? Actually, I touched on this the last time I was looking at this passage. But you know, God has been very gracious to this man Belshazzar. You remember when Daniel comes to speak to him, Daniel reminds him of his history, of his family's history. And Daniel says to him in verse 18, O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar your father kingship and greatness and glory and majesty. And because of the greatness that he gave him, all peoples, nations and languages trembled and feared before him. But when his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened so that he dealt proudly, he was brought down from his kingly throne. And then Daniel applies this to Belshazzar. And Daniel says to him in verse 22, and you, his son, Belshazzar, you have not humbled yourself. You've not humbled your heart, though you knew all this. But you have lifted yourself up against the Lord of heaven. And the vessels of his house have been brought in before you. And you and your lords and your wives and your concubines have drunk wine from them. God has been gracious to Belshazzar, because God had wonderful dealings with Belshazzar's ancestor, Nebuchadnezzar. I know in our passage it says his father. Actually, it wasn't his father. It was a few generations before that, because there was a time gap there. But you remember when we looked at chapter 4 and how God dealt with Nebuchadnezzar. And here was this proud, arrogant man, Nebuchadnezzar. And God dealt with him. And Nebuchadnezzar went into the field and ate grass like the oxen. And then when the time came, God restored his mind to him, his intelligence to him. And you remember how when Nebuchadnezzar was restored, Nebuchadnezzar wrote certain words. You read this in chapter 4 from verse 34. And Nebuchadnezzar said, his dominion is an everlasting dominion. His kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing. And he does according to his will among the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. And none can stay his hand or say to him, what have you done? Nebuchadnezzar wrote Daniel chapter 4. It was he who wrote it. You read Daniel chapter 4. It's Nebuchadnezzar writing this chapter. And Nebuchadnezzar is writing in the history books of his nation so that his successors learn some lessons. Because that's what history is supposed to do. History is recorded that we may learn lessons. And Nebuchadnezzar thinks to himself, I'd better write down this incident in my life so that my successors learn the lessons. You mustn't be proud. You mustn't be arrogant. You mustn't stand and rebel against the God of heaven. And so he wrote his testimony. All these passages he wrote to say, look, I made a stand against God. And God judged me. And I became like an animal in the wild, and I ate grass. Because I made a stand against God and rebelled against God. And I learned my lesson. And I've written it down here for you, that there is one God in heaven. And he is sovereign. And he is to be honored and worshipped. So all this was written down. If Belshazzar had consulted the history books, he would have seen it. Actually, he had consulted the history books. Because Daniel says to him, he says, you have not humbled yourselves, you've not humbled your heart, though you knew all this. You're not ignorant of the history of your nation, Belshazzar. You knew all this. But you haven't learned the history, the lessons of history. So you see, God has been gracious to Belshazzar. Because God moved Nebuchadnezzar to write that history that Belshazzar may learn. And Belshazzar needn't have done any of this. Belshazzar should have read history and should have said to himself, I'm not going to lift up my hand against the one true living God. But he wouldn't take advantage of God's grace. Do you know, this is probably the greatest sin a human being can commit. When God is gracious to us, and God in grace offers us the gifts of heaven, and we turn away from Him and we say, we don't want your gift, thank you very much. You're being gracious to us, but we don't want your grace, thank you. We want to follow our own way. That is the sin of unbelief. Belshazzar, God was gracious to him in teaching him a lesson from one of his ancestors. The history recorded, he would not learn. But God was gracious. And God is gracious. We must never ever forget this. We live in a land that is hostile to the Christian faith. And it's very easy to become bitter and angry. It's very easy to become discouraged. It's very easy to think, well, the nation has gone away from the Christian faith and we'll never ever be a Christian nation again. Very easy to become discouraged. But God is gracious. And no nation can ever sin their way out of the grace of God. You can't sin your way out of the grace of God. You remember what Paul says to the Romans, where sin abounded, grace abounded even more. We used to sing a hymn in Swahili, and it said, sin has traveled down a very long road. The road down which sin travels is a very long road. But the road along which grace travels is longer still. I used to love that hymn because it's such a lovely hymn. And it expresses this beautiful truth that the grace of God is always greater than the sin of man. The grace of God is always greater. It's greater than the sin of this nation. It is greater than the rebellion of this nation. So remember this great truth as you live in a nation that is hostile to the gospel. Remember this, God is sovereign and God is gracious. And pray for this nation. Yes, the nation is far from God and some of the sins being committed are terrible sins. But God doesn't save people because they deserve salvation. God saves because He is gracious. So you see, you can pray for anybody because God is gracious. So remember that and pray for this nation as we live in a hostile world. So God is sovereign, God is gracious. And then the third lesson from this passage about God, and it is this, that God is holy and just. Belshazzar has rebelled against God. Belshazzar knows who God is. Belshazzar has read the history that his ancestor Nebuchadnezzar has written. And Belshazzar knows that there is one God in heaven who is sovereign and who is the one true living God. And Belshazzar sins against him with a high hand. And Belshazzar issues this command, bring those vessels of gold and silver that they used to use for the worship of their God, and we will use them for our pleasure and for the worship of our God. It is rebellion against God. It is a premeditated rebellion against God. There's no accident here. This is not one of those things that Belshazzar didn't know what these vessels were. When you look at the way he talks about them, it says he commanded that the vessels of gold and silver that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken out of the temple in Jerusalem be brought. So that's how he specified. He said, you know those vessels in the temple in Jerusalem? You know those vessels that the Jews used to use for the worship of their God? You know the Jews used to say their God is the one true living God and we must all worship Him alone. And they used to use those vessels. Well, I'm going to show you that their God isn't the one true living God. Bring those vessels. We will use them for drinking wine for our pleasure. We will use them to worship our gods. It's a deliberate, premeditated rebellion against God. And when men sin in this way against God, God judges, because God is holy and God is just. And so when Daniel spoke to him, Daniel said, you knew who God was. You've read the history of your country. You knew who God is. And despite knowing who God is, you've raised your hand in rebellion against him. And so God has spoken. And God has said that the days are numbered. Now, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. You have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. And your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. And we read in verse 30, that very night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was killed. We don't know how he was killed. Was he struck down by God? Well, there were people in the Bible who were struck down by God and died. Was it enemy action? Was it the Medes and the Persians whom God brought to do it? We don't know. But it's very clear from the way it is written that this is the action of God. Because God is holy and God is just and God judges sin. God will always offer salvation to all. And God will plead with the worst of sinners to come to him. And God in grace will provide salvation for the worst of sinners. But when men and women remain in rebellion and will not turn to him and will not believe, then there's only one thing awaiting them, judgment. Belshazzar wouldn't listen, and then judgment came. And friends, we need to remember this for our own selves. God is reaching to us with his salvation. And we must make sure we do respond in repentance and in faith. And we must trust Jesus alone. We mustn't trust in our works. We mustn't trust in our church attendance. We mustn't trust in our claims to be Christian. Jesus Christ alone saves. We must trust him. But if we seek not to, if we are determined not to trust in Christ, but rebellious, God will judge. And there is a place called hell. And it is a place of eternal punishment. And all who reject Christ will be in hell for eternity. God is holy and God is just. So three lessons about God to remember as we live in a hostile world. God is sovereign. He hasn't lost the compass. God is gracious. We must always pray for our nation. And God is holy and just. We must make sure we do trust in Christ and have believed in him for our salvation.